Hello and welcome to the Guardian Film Show. Sam Brooks is lost between worlds, spun out somewhere between Asgard and Greenwich, and I'm here, a Loki-like apparition, to do my best impression. Now, what comes next? Oh yeah, here's what's coming up on this week's show. Chris Hemsworth gets topless briefly and swings his hammer around a lot in Marvel's Thor: The Dark World. Olivia Wilde and Anna Kendrick brew up romantic entanglement in Joe Swanberg's Drinking Buddies. And Paulina Garcia is 50-something, free and single in Chilean divorcee drama Gloria. But let's start the show with Philomena, Stephen Frears' take on the real-life story of Philomena Lee. Judi Dench plays our hero on the hunt for the son who was snatched from her by nuns and sold to America 50 years ago. Catherine Shaw met Judi Dench to talk about staying true to this incredible real-life story.
I'm getting scared. Now we're getting closer. All these years wondering whether Anthony was in trouble or in prison or goodness knows where. But as long as I didn't know, I could always tell myself he was happy somewhere and that he was doing all right.
Even just this morning, talking now, she told me again, she told me the whole story just now and said it was all for the love of Anthony I did it. And that's why, as I've said, that our responsibility to her and to Marty Sixsmith and to the whole story is very, very great.
They said that you had abandoned him as a baby.
I did not abandon my child.
Anthony!
He'll be 50 today.
Who is it?
Your wife tells me you think you're mildly depressed.
Well, I got the sack. I'm unemployed.
Yes, but it wasn't your fault, was it?
That's why I'm depressed.
This is Martin Sixsmith, used to be the BBC's man in Moscow, became a spin doctor for the government, and it all went a bit tits up.
I always say, you know, if you shovel shit for long enough, eventually you're going to get some on your shoes.
Yes, you got it on your head. How do you manage that?
Did it make you feel any differently about investigative reporting?
Well, I think that's essential. But I think that there must be a boundary. There must be a very delicate boundary over which it's hard to step. But it must be done, and the more opaque things are, the better. Is opaque clear, or is it misty? I never know. Is opaque clear?
I get that mixed
up. Oh, no, tights. No, it's not. I don't mean the more opaque.
Transparent.
It's exactly what I mean. The more transparent things are, and the more that we understand, and the more things are up front, of course the better. Of course the better. However painful, really.
Joining me now is Catherine Shaw and The Guardian's film critic, Peter Bradshaw. Catherine, Steve Coogan read about this in The Guardian, right? So let's get the chest-puffing stuff out of the way first.
Yeah, no, that's right. He read about it online in 2009. I think it was a first-person piece by Martin Sixsmith in the Weekend magazine. Mm. And actually, I think it's really significant that he read about it like that and not actually by buying... You know, he optioned the book, but he didn't read the book first, yeah. Because that article online has got a big picture of Martin Sixsmith and Philomena Lee kind of laughing on a bench. And just like the poster, it's sort of them laughing on a virtual bench. And because, you know, you read the book itself and it's the backstory of Philomena and it's, you know, all about all that. It's all the flashback stuff in the film. And what he and Jeff Pope, who's his co-writer on this, have done is shove that odd couple story centre stage and make that the sort of main driving force, which is kind of genius. I mean, I think it works unbelievably well. And if you'd just done it like the book, it wouldn't have been so good. And they've done quite a lot of kind of narrative massage on what actually happened, especially in terms of the investigation, which, you know, again, gives you sort of more respect for the screenplay at the end of the day, I think.
Peter, it is funny, but it's a tragedy at the same time. Did you feel Coogan managed to walk that line well enough?
I think he did. I think exactly as Catherine says, they found this incredible story. They have serendipitously found this story, but created this great odd couple relationship, which, if it was straight fiction from a straight Hollywood movie, there would have been much more Route One stuff. There would have been much more stuff about how Martin Sixsmith behaved with his own mother. Does he have a quasi-maternal relationship with Philomena? All those things were gestured at, but quite subtly, it kind of stepped back from making too much of them. And of course, the idea of his own redemption is as somebody who'd got mired in that rather nasty world of New Labour political spin and found something of his, some real act of goodness to bring about.
He's still quite unpleasant, though, for a lot
of people.
He
is a bit unpleasant. The problem with Martin Sixsmith, I think, is that he never admits he ever did anything wrong. That's the thing. And so that's why I think his character is a little bit opaque in this. But it works very well because it contributes to the oddity. It makes you think that, yes, this is real and not just a slushy sucrose Hollywood story.
But for me, the relationship between the two of them, it reminds me, if anything, most of all of The Trip. Because, you know, the thing is, she's always undercutting him, just like Rob Brydon's always undercutting him. You know, he's sort of saying, you know, that scene where he says, you know, I've always found it a very difficult question to answer simply, you know, do you believe in God? And she said, and he says, do you? And she says, yes.
Yeah, but there is there's an element with her character that she's still very innocent in her own way, maybe because of her religion. I keep going back to this idea that she's talking about the romantic novels in the film, and she's really invested in these romantic books that are completely predictable, and Steve Coogan's character is like, oh yeah, I know what's going to happen next. And to me, there's an element of this film that is, yeah, I know what's going to happen next, and it is comfy in that way as well. I felt that.
I was completely blindsided by what happened next in the film. I had no idea about it. I found it very surprising and intriguing. I must say, I didn't get it. I
mean, the final act is cosy. The way the story ends is cosy. It's a great story because of that.
If you guess what happens in this, you're some kind of wizard. I never saw. There's two big twists, and I saw neither of them coming.
I must say, I don't agree. No, I mean, it closes with a click, undoubtedly, but I didn't find it cosy at all. And I think it had something to say about modern Ireland in a way. I mean, it's less obviously grandiloquent and angry than Peter Mullen's film about the unmarried mothers of Ireland and the Magdalene sisters, but it still had something to say on the subject.
I think it's populist. It's populist and mainstream, but it's not predictable. It's confounding, in fact. You know, every turn, even within a scene, you think this scene is starting off like comic business in the breakfast buffet and Judi Dench is going on about the omelettes. And then it's like suddenly into quite deep tragedy.
Almost quite sour as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, he's really quite rude to her, and it's quite shocking sometimes. I think it's populist and mainstream, and it hits the notes simply, but it isn't a simple script, and it isn't, what's going on between them isn't simple.
And it rather cleverly anticipates our rather broadsheet-style snobbery about human interest stories, because, let's face it, we all sort of thought, yes, it's a human interest story. Martin Sixsmith said, yes, human interest stories are slushy stories by and for weak-minded people, and we sort of thought, this is what this film is going to be about. But interestingly, no, not like that at all.
Coffee?
No, thank you.
OK, well, if you want to help yourself to breakfast over there, we have two buffets, hot and cold, fresh fruit, cereal.
She just told me.
omelettes with your choice of filling.
I know exactly what's on display over there.
We also have fresh pancakes.
Thank you. Trying to have a private conversation.
My apologies, sir.
There's no need to be rude. She's a very nice person.
I know. I'm sure she's one in a million, or one in 100,000.
What do you mean?
Well, you said it to about 10 people, so that's just maths.
You should be nice to the people on the way up, because you might meet them again on the way down. Now, you of all people should understand that.
Judi Dench and Steve Coogan in Philomena there. And now for something with much more bang, crash and bluster. It's been a good 10 seconds since the release of the last Marvel superhero film, so thank the Norse heavens for Thor and his mighty mystical mallet. We sent our own God of Thunder, Ben Child, down to meet the cast of Thor: The Dark World.
After all this time, now you come to visit me, brother. Why? To mock.
I need your help. But I wish I could trust you.
If you did, you'd be the fool I always took you for.
Loki has basically killed tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of people back on Earth. He's a pretty bad guy. Why doesn't Thor just smash him with his big hammer?
It's a really good question. It's a legitimately good question.
Because that wouldn't be a very interesting movie. The film would stop.
Yeah.
He's his brother. You know what I mean? Yeah. And
that's what I think is interesting, is that inside this great sort of fantasy is quite a simple relationship between brothers, you know, two brothers who love each other and hate each other and define each other and need each other. And I think that is, for me, that's the most interesting thing to play in these films.
Are you guys geeks, or does it all go over your head?
I'm a little bit of a
She's
geek,
a geek.
I guess.
I'm not a geek.
I'm really excited. I mean, I'm a Marvel fan and a comic book fan, so I love that stuff. I get a little bit excited, especially 3D, which is really awesome. So it's exciting for me.
I wish I were more. I feel like all like the really smart, interesting people are into really like geeky about this stuff.
Yeah, you're not smart or interesting, Natalie.
No, I'm not. Not like you. Not like you,
oh,
man.
So I
love these worlds and getting to play in them, but it's definitely not my like zone of.
Natalie is more of finding those things in reality situations.
Yeah, exactly.
Finding the magic in real life.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jane.
Sorry, I just needed to make sure you were real. It's been a very strange day.
I am. Jane, what?
Where were you?
Where were you? Heimdall could not see you.
I was right here where you left me. I was waiting, and then I was crying, and then I went out looking for you. You said you were coming back.
I know, but the Bifrost was destroyed. The Nine Realms erupted into chaos. Wars were raging. Marauders were pillaging. I had to put an end to the slaughter.
As excuses go, it's not terrible.
Peter, Thor, Core or Snore?
Sort of Snore. I mean, I liked the first Thor film. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed Chris Hemsworth in Avengers Assemble. But the thing about Hemsworth is that I think he's good. I like him, but he needs a non-blonde actor to play off against. If it's just as in Rush with Daniel Brühl, and of course in Thor, it's Loki, played by Tom Hiddleston. This
you don't just mean blonde hair, you mean light and dark, right?
Light and dark, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. That's the symbolism I'm talking about. I found this very boring, to be honest with you. I found the villains of the piece were Malekith and the Dark Elves. And it just ties weights to your eyelids. It's so boring, frankly. And Christopher Eccleston phones it in. He really does phone it in. He's mostly in makeup and CGI and everything like that. Mm. And Tom Hiddleston's Loki, who's usually such a good turn. I mean, he's always hilarious. And he's very good in this too, but there's just so little of him. Mm. He's sidelined. I mean, he wasn't the villain in the first film. I mean, the villains in the first film were these frost giants, and now it's the Dark Elves. And Loki's sort of the kind of the Brit comedy turn. But there's so little of him. And this is just, I don't know, it's just more product coming out of the Marvel pipeline. I think it is... It's whacked out pretty soon after the last Thor film, which was only a couple of years ago. I found I was watching pure fanboy product, basically, and I got the sense that it never came to life. It was just put together. It all looks good, but it exists in this green screen world, the CGI green screen world, and none of the fun and the wit and the novelty that the Kenneth Branagh film had was present here.
I mean, this is part of the Marvel master plan, right? You've got Captain America Winter Soldier coming out next year, and then you've got Age of Ultron, the second Avengers film. People still want to see these films. They're still going on. You know, they're not going to stop.
They do. I mean, like, the kids in the row next to me were going, you know, they were going crazy with laughing and happiness and excitement. They were really whooping it up. Mm. But you know, the rest of us... on the floor.
And then there's one area we absolutely have to call out, which is the Charing Cross travel advice. There's a bit where Thor gets on the tube,
yes,
right?
Yes, terrible.
He gets on the
asks for advice to get to Greenwich from Charing Cross, and then she just says, oh, it's three stops.
Three stops?
Bullshit.
What?
It's
yes.
Not. What and is it, Henry? It's two stops, change for the Jubilee.
Then you change on the Jubilee, or possibly the DLR. No. And interestingly, we don't see him get out of the tube. No, he just appears later on in Greenwich. Also, we haven't seen him getting lost.
He's a superhero. He doesn't need the tube.
He can fly.
He can go between worlds.
That's a pure bit of sub-Skyfall kind of location tourist work, isn't it? It's pretty feeble.
And but it's all for the lady, because the lady says, oh, yes, three stops. And then she sort of falls against
and then she
him.
Falls, ooh,
like,
ooh. Yeah.
But it's like Natalie Portman says at one point, I love how you explain things. And it's so kind of, ooh.
She's an astrophysicist
she's
as well.
One of the top astrophysicists in the world.
Yeah.
And she loves how Chris Hemsworth explains things.
That's what I like about Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
Thor, your bravery will not ease your pain. Your family. Your world will be extinguished.
We're running out of time.
The very fabric of reality will be torn apart.
There we go then, four roaring, warring, and indeed boring us senseless in the dark world. And as Catherine suggested, I have done my research from Charing Cross, couple of stops south to Waterloo, take the Jubilee line east to North Greenwich, and it's still a bit of a walk from there. Anyway, on to the next one. This one's from him out of Mumblecore. It's Joe Swanberg's Drinking Buddies.
Stop working so hard. I don't want you guys to strain yourself.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Kate.
Some Greek salad?
It's disgusting. I'm trying not to get scurvy.
Come on, not my beer.
That's an expert beer tasting technique.
Olivia Wilde and Jake Johnson slosh around a brewery, drunk on beer and high on sexual tension. Joe Swanberg's comedy drama serves up a bittersweet brew. Let's call it romantic befuddlement.
Heard a lot of great things about you, and we're excited to have you.
Really? Good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Catherine, what kind of romantic drama are we getting here? What kind of taste? Is it dark and stormy, light and frothy? What do you reckon?
I'd say it's like something like a Picpoul de Pinay, because it's it's the sort of wine that you'd like to drink if you were slightly richer and better looking and just better. And this is a kind of relationship drama that you're meant to think, God, it's just like me. Mm. But aspirationally, yes. Obviously. I mean, you know, these people, they drink so... Olivia Wilde drinks so much, eats so much. She's still...
Still Olivia Wilde, yeah.
It's great, though. I really did enjoy it. It's kind of boring after a while, because you think, Christ, either get together or don't. But it's just very interesting, I think. I think a lot of people will really like it. And I did really like it for a lot of it.
Only Joe Swanberg could have set a romantic drama in an artisanal brewery and... Brooklyn somewhere. Is it in Brooklyn?
I think it's supposed to be Chicago, isn't it? I can't remember. I think it's interesting. I like the idea of everybody drinking all the time and getting drunk. Again, it's sort of giving the middle finger to Hollywood movies which never show people getting drunk, never show people drinking, unless it's for a very specific contemporary comic effect, or to show them having alcoholism. And that word is never mentioned.
We had that film Smashed last year, which was about young people drinking too much, but it was deadly
serious. That's
what
it's about. And I did quite like the kind of incorrectness of the fact that nobody mentions alcoholism. They're not alcoholics, they just like to drink all the time. And, you know, you don't have a problem with that, surely. In real life, sometimes things don't come to a crux. You can go on for ages, especially if you're always going out and always getting drunk. And the thing about getting drunk is that you're disinhibited, but you also lose your nerve in some other ways, and so everything turns into a big drunken blur, and nothing comes to a crunch. And I suspect it's also part of the mumblecore improv technique, where you kind of go on and on and on forever, and everybody's always laughing uproariously at what everybody else says. And I was thinking, have they said anything funny? Are they supposed to be drunk? It's a bit of an improv mannerism, I think. But again, it's interesting, and it's certainly consistent and distinctive, and he maintains it all the way through.
Is it even fair to be using tags like mumblecore anymore, especially for this film, or are we kind of done with that now? Like, I think Swanberg is sick to death of it, and probably rightly so. But.
Yeah, it's kind of post-mumblecore, isn't it? And actually, it just feels like a fairly regular drama, although quite a distinctive tang. Mm. It's also, I think what Peter's saying about how the sexual tension never quite kind of fizzes after that initial thing, I think it's partly about beer, isn't it? Mm. If they were all drinking gin all the time, they'd, you know,
it would
be very different, Jägermeister. You know, it's because they're drinking beer all night, so they kind of go on and on and on, and they kind of, you know, get sleepy and lose their sex drive.
Gin.
Yeah, exactly. If it was gin or even wine it might have been different. Yeah. But yes, the sheer volume of beer.
Beer's just not sexy. No.
This is the problem with heartbreak, is that to you it's like an atomic bomb, and to the world it's just really cliche, because in the end we all have the same experience.
That's the sexy friends of Drinking Buddies blurring the boundaries with booze. Give them a painful breakup, a couple of decades of therapy, and they'll be back on the market. Much like the star of our next film, Gloria's out on the town and looking for love, divorcee style. Let's see how she gets on.
Sí.
Joaquín.
Sí.
Soy Gloria.
Gloria.
Gloria cumplido.
Gloria is a decade divorced and hungry for love. Rodolfo is a year divorced and newly trim following a gastric bypass. Together, they can build a wonderful future, right? wrong. This drama about middle-aged dating in Chile is a cautionary tale about the neediness of children and the irrational tugs of the heart. Peter, this premiered at the Berlin Film Festival, which is a place that you normally associate very kind of cold, icy drama with, but it's not like that at all.
No, it's very warm and very rich, and I found a very rewarding film. I really liked what was going on at the centre of it, this woman who was genuinely looking for love and also very candidly looking for sex too. It's one of those films which is very candid about the sex lives of older people in a way that lots of movies aren't. That subject tends to get deflected into some form of bittersweet sentimentalism, but not here. It's very candid about sex and the fact that shock horror, after the age of 50 and after your marriage is over and even after you've got grown-up children, you still have these inconvenient sexual feelings which have to be catered to some way or another. And so she's out and about, she's kind of meeting guys, these silver foxy kind of guys who take her out on dates. But there's an awful thing that happens, that even though they go to hotel rooms and they go to bed, they have sex and it's all great, guess what? They all have baggage. They all have terrible baggage to do with their ex-husbands or their ex-wives, or a lot of the time they're grown-up children. They tend to be huge figures, of course, in their lives, and you're not sure whether or not you want to take on an older partner's massive extended family. And you think, what am I entitled to as an older person? Am I surely entitled to the hedonistic life of somebody who's young, free and single, or not young, free and single, but free and single? And the other interesting idea is that maybe this love that you're encountering, maybe that's the real thing. Maybe it's not a kind of second time around thing. Maybe this is the one after all, and you just didn't meet early enough. But maybe this is the authentic love that you didn't have in your 20s and 30s. So I think there was a lot of really interesting ideas going on in this film.
Catherine, it's centred on Gloria for pretty much the whole movie. And there's a tendency with modern Chilean films to read a political element into them as well. Do you think there is one in this film, or is it simply a standalone tale about one woman and her story?
I didn't pick it up. I wasn't really looking for it. Yeah. But I haven't picked that up, no. I mean, it's, you know, it seems to be exactly what Peter said it was. And, you know, it's interesting that this year you've had Enough Said. And the film most reminded me of, in fact, was The Great Beauty, the Sorrentino film, particularly the sort of scenes of older people partying and all that. I really love that. It's got a real kind of tang to it, you know, like Drinking Buddies. No, it's a terrific film, absolutely fascinating. But I hadn't really picked up a political thing.
It might be there. I mean, it's tempting to read a political analogy in where it's not there. I think it's interesting. It's a generational movie, and there are dinner party scenes where they talk about the younger generation and how much they feel sorry for them and how they think they are. The younger generation is disenfranchised, and they, as it were, politically or emotionally, they don't know what to think about Chile's past. And I think it is interesting. They are the generation that lived through 73. They are the generation who kind of experienced it firsthand. And perhaps almost like East Germans who are kind of sentimental about it, they're not sentimental for Pinochet particularly, but Pinochet's rule came and went without any great seismic change for them. And they probably think, well, we're not sentimental for Pinochet, but then perhaps we're not sentimental for Salvador Allende either. What are we sentimental for? What is our history? Where do our loyalties lie in the past? And I think there is something of that going on in the deep background, but it's not an overtly political film, no.
Gloria. Gloria.
Gloria going out in considerable style, and we'll take our cue from her. Thanks to Catherine Short and Peter Bradshaw for joining me. Thanks to you for watching. The Seven Realms will be aligned just in time for Zan Brooks to return next week, so we'll see you then.